Welcome to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour. I'm Kate Koff, editor of the Maine Monitor. The Maine Monitor is the nonpartisan, independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We are a nonprofit organization dedicated to delivering high-quality, nonpartisan, investigative and explanatory journalism to inform Mainers about issues across our state and to empower them to be engaged citizens. This program is a collaboration between WERU-FM and the Maine Monitor. Each month, a panel of reporters and editors will talk about the stories we're working on, many of which you've likely read in your local newspaper or at themainemonitor.org. This month, I'm joined by our environmental reporter, Emmett Gartner, and our Report for America Corps member, Sean Scott, who covers religion, policy, politics, and society. We'll be talking today about their recent reporting on how tariffs have affected Maine's loggers and sawmills, the debate over whether federal immigration agents can wear masks or otherwise conceal their identities, and how that compares to rules for local police, and more. So Emmett, we're going to start with you. You have been reporting a lot recently on Maine's forestry industry. We're going to talk about three stories you've written, two that focus on the impacts of tariffs on loggers and sawmills, and another that looked at forest pests and diseases. I want to start with the first tariff story. You went out into the woods near Newry earlier this winter to meet with the folks that run a logging company. Before we get into all the financial issues that the piece delves into, just tell us what it was like to see their operation firsthand.
Yeah, it was really something. So I went out there in November and I met up with Dana Doran of Maine Professional Loggers and Contractors of the Northeast, a lobbying group for the wood product sector here in New England. And because of the road conditions and my car's abilities, I was forced to, not forced, but I was able to ride with him up to this logging operation in Newry, where Andy Irish and his family company, Irish Family Logging, had gotten underway with the logging season and were doing some cutting on this really beautiful section of forest land off of some dirt forest roads. They have to wait to do the operation until winter. It's common across Maine because that's when the roads freeze, can support their trucks, the logging trucks, and all of the heavy equipment without putting too much of an impact or footprint on the land itself. So we went up there and met with Andy and his crew, and it was just this intense orchestra of machinery kind of operating in full swing, but what seemed like chaos was just so particularly organized. I mean, each machine was cutting logs, felling trees, and then delimbing them, sometimes debarking them, trimming them down to certain lengths, piling them up onto trucks, and then the truck would take off, and then they'd start the whole process over again. So it was just this loop, and each machine was kind of just in perfect harmony with one another. Some of the trees that they were cutting were these smaller, scraggly hardwood species that is often sent to paper mills to be chipped and turned into pulpwood, which is then converted to paper pulp. So that's kind of what happened at the edge of the forest operation. And then there are also these larger logs that they're cutting, softwood trees, spruce and pine, that gets sent to sawmills to be turned into more high-value lumber. So they were doing both at the time, and loggers really need to do both in order to make a profit. When they go in for these designated logging operations, the forest plan is drawn up months in advance. It gets all the clearance from state officials, and they kind of designate which materials go where. And when they go in and fell these trees, you know, there's this outside scraggle that needs to be cleared to get to some other high value trees. And it also kind of aligns with how the forest is growing, where it is in its certain cycle. All this is kind of plotted out. And then contractors like Irish, they're hired to put the plan into place. I mean, it was a beautiful day. This was in November. So it really, I hadn't seen full winter in swing yet, but it was just a winter wonderland up there. Snow was falling down. The roads were slick. We were walking around and had our hard hats on and slipping here and there on the ice, but we're able to see just the full motion of everything. And it was pretty incredible.
Wow, that sounds very complicated. So yeah, tell us, I mean, you told us a little bit, but tell us more about Andy and his logging company. How long has the company been around?
Yeah, so they're based out of Rumford, and he's been in the industry since the 1970s. He says things have changed a lot since then. With business in logging, there are ups and downs. And over the past few decades that he's been working, he's seen basically things balance out over time. Some hard times might be followed by good ones, and he kind of just plans for the long term. He has this great quote that I just have to read out loud because I think it sums up everything about him pretty well. He said, "An old guy told me a long time ago, if you're in this business, there are going to be some years that you just got to eat the costs. But I'm not sure how this is going to go." And that's in reference to the tariffs. This was early on, just a couple months after the Trump administration slapped on some 10% tariffs on Canadian timber, and they kind of just complicated the supply chain at the time. So there's a little bit uncertainty for him initially. So, when we're thinking about his kind of long-term operations, those years that the old guy said he's going to have to eat the costs, initially this seemed like it could be one of them for him.
And yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about the tariffs. What did he have to say about how they're affecting his business?
Yeah, so I mean, just over the past month since I've reported on this piece, things have changed a little bit. But early on, immediately after the tariffs, Woodland Pulp, their mill in Baileyville, their pulp mill in Baileyville, they stopped accepting timber, hardwood pulp from both Canada and Maine. Canadian timber, because they're right on the border, takes up a chunk of the raw material that they use in the pulp making process. So at that time, because the costs kind of complicated things, I mean, mill officials never told me that they stopped operations directly because of the tariffs, but they certainly said that they stopped operations after the tariffs. So there was a month and a half, month long period where the plant or the mill was not turning out any pulp. And with that, kind of causes chain reaction throughout the Maine forest products industry. Because once one major player stops buying pulp wood, then other loggers who might be up in that area who sell to Woodland Pulp, all of a sudden they're looking down south at ND Paper in Rumford, at Sappi Somerset Mill, looking for somewhere to offload this lower value wood that they need to sell to make a profit. So at that time, Andy was, a little cautious about how these tariffs would impact things. At the same time, too, there, in addition to these timber tariffs, there was also tariffs on forestry equipment, electronics, other pieces that are needed to, either repair the machines that Andy uses for this complex operation or the machines themselves. Andy does this practice that isn't too common with all loggers in Maine, which is to cut a lot of the logs that he sells to sawmills right there at the operation. It's called cut to length equipment. And that equipment isn't manufactured in the United States. You can get something similar to it, but for really the high tech needs that his company has, that equipment has to come from Canada or Scandinavia. So at the time, he was all right. He had, these $500,000 pieces of equipment that were running well. They were making repairs as needed. That wasn't an issue. But say he wants to buy a piece of equipment like that down the line if something breaks down, or he wants to upgrade or expand operations. At that time, that kind of caused some confusion for him because of the complexities.
Yeah, I mean, and we should, you noted this, but we should also make a point that we're recording on February 26th, and this will air a week from today. And with the tariffs are changing day to day at this point, so it'll be interesting to see where we are a week out. You also talked to other loggers and industry experts for the story. What did they have to say about how the tariffs are affecting the forest product supply chain? Because it was kind of different reactions across the board.
Yeah, no, and it really depends on geography too. So I spoke with Andy, but I also spoke with another logger up in Allegash, Marty Pelletier, and his family company, his fourth generation logging company, Silver Logging Inc. And they have a more direct relationship with the Woodland Pulp Mill. So when Woodland Pulp stopped accepting hardwood, that really hurt them. It caused them to, lose a big buyer, and it complicated how they would sell this hardwood pulp that pulpwood that they needed to offload to, make their whole operation profitable. So he early on, told me that the tariffs really concerned him. I also spoke with an equipment importer in Vermont who sells some of this high-tech machinery that Irish uses at his operations. And he told me that at that time they stopped importing those pieces of equipment altogether because the price tag was just too high. They've already been hit by inflation, and that is another underlying thing I should mention. Inflation is just this underlying complexity that makes all of this more difficult for everyone. So equipment prices had already been going up. Now all of a sudden you have to pay this giant tariff on top of that. So he was kind of sticking to waited out to see how things would change before he purchased or imported, a big expensive piece of equipment that he might not be able to pass the cost to a buyer like Irish if the time came. So, that was another big caveat to everything. And in speaking with Dana Doran of the logging group, I'm sorry, the wood products group, he also said that, these tariffs, if they're going to be successful and boost manufacturing domestically, as is the stated goal by the Trump administration, then there has to be more investment into the manufacturing side of things as well. And we'll get to that later, I think. But at that time, it just wasn't as clear whether that manufacturing boost would come. So if this disruption in the overall kind of supply chain of raw timber with the Canadian timber tariffs happens, and there's not this assurance that the manufacturing side will be able to pick things up, then it causes uncertainty. And uncertainty, as it is across the business world, across the economy, is very difficult for loggers to account for. I mean, a lot of these forestry plans are, like I said, developed months out. These forests are on very specific schedules of harvesting. I also spoke with University of Maine professors about this, and when it comes to the management of Maine's forests to keep them kind of healthy and productive, and have them stay as this backbone of Maine's economy, there needs to be the harvesting of this pulpwood. And if there's no value to it, then again, forests, their management plans get more complicated. The profit margins for the logging companies gets more complicated, and same for the woodlot owners.
You've sort of you've hinted at a lot of this as we've been talking, but can you just for readers who are not very familiar with the logging industry, can you just tell us some examples of hardwood, softwood, like what are the different kinds of trees we're talking about here?
So, hardwood is maple, ash, it's trees with leaves. And then softwood, it depends on where you are. Like I've spoken with lumber manufacturers like Robbins Lumber in Searsmont, and they work with pine a lot. That's their main saw log. So that's their softwood saw log that they buy and produce lumber of different dimension wood used for housing, whatever it might be. And then on the hardwood side, that is kind of the scrappy wood that I was talking about that gets sold to the paper mills for manufacturing, referred to as pulp wood. So that could be ash, could be birch, maple. Those are the kind of trees I'm referring to.
And just quickly out of curiosity, you mentioned that Andy's kind of unique and that he does this cut to length on site. Why is that not more common? Is it just the expense of the equipment and that it's so specialized?
The expense of the equipment, and I think it's just the complexity of the operation itself. I mean, like I said, it's all of these moving pieces. So you have to have the crew that can support it. You have to have the money to afford the machinery, to afford, the interest rates that you're paying, as you're paying off the equipment. And in doing so, it's kind of this cost benefit analysis because you can get more value out of it when you go to sell it to sawmills, compared to other, logs that you might send that will need a little bit more, pre, cutting before it can be processed by the sawmills. So he has, run his operation in this way that he thinks it's profitable to do it this way. I mean, he has the skilled labor. He's got his family members, his sons working, and he's got a strong crew. Sometimes you hear in the logging industry that employment, like of future generations, is a concern. But surprisingly, with a lot, and this is kind of a tangent, but with a lot of the folks that I spoke with, that's not really on their mind too much. They see a young and willing workforce out there who wants to work in the woods. As long as you have the people who can operate that machinery and make good money off of it, then for Irish, it seems worthwhile to buy this more expensive equipment.
That's interesting that you they didn't sound concerned about the future workforce, because I've heard that same thing from folks in reporting on this issue.
I know, and it's like something. As a reporter, sometimes you go out and expecting to hear one thing.
Yeah.
Obviously, that's not what you're selling the story on. It's not what you're going to sit down and write. You're listening and hearing what people have to say. And I know that Dana Doran and other industry players have been helping fund and put together some workforce development programs. And maybe that's part of it. I think another part of it is that I've spoke with a lot of family operations and, that just brings in different generations and it brings in their friends. Everyone at the logging operation I went to was pretty jovial. They were having a good time. I mean, the machinery would sometimes they'd have to stop and get out and fix something and bang on something and, the snow's falling. They got their hard hats on. They're doing what they need to do, but they're having a good time.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, especially because you have to do so much of it in winter. I've always thought of it as an extremely physically and mentally demanding job. I remember seeing pictures of like men logging in the woods, and they'd be, many decades ago, but they'd be out there for like months on end, and they've got the logging camps, and it's really, yeah, it sounded just very demanding, but also sounds like there's a lot of camaraderie. So,
Yeah, I'm sure it
yeah.
still is
Yeah,
very
very
demanding,
demanding
but
still, yeah.
they have heated cabins now, so I think that helps a little bit.
That's pretty, that's probably nice, a little bit nicer. Well, let's talk, you dug into what it looks like for loggers quite a bit, but you also decided to take a closer look at what it's meant for kind of another area of the industry, which is sawmills. You went to Pleasant River Lumber in Enfield for this piece. So tell us a little bit about that company and the family that runs it.
So I actually heard from them after my first piece published. I had all of the caveats that I've explained thus far, but they really wanted to provide a little bit more input about what they were seeing because there's all this talk. You have to boost domestic manufacturing. If these tariffs are going to work, you got to have it on the supply side. And they were saying that we feel confident to boost manufacturing. We think these tariffs are kind of protecting us against these Canadian timber prices that have long plagued American lumber manufacturers. I mean, another thing to keep in mind is that this ongoing dispute between the US and Canada over Canadian timber prices goes back decades. The tariffs are just kind of the latest chapter in this ongoing saga. Just the way Canadian timber harvesting works, and because a lot of it is harvested from provincial or federal land in Canada, it means that loggers there pay less than some might here in Maine or the US to cut wood and then sell it and import it across the border for lower prices that undercut Maine loggers. So I spoke with Jason and Chris Brochu. They're two brothers who are co-presidents of Pleasant River Lumber. They have both their sawmill in Enfield. It's a softwood lumber manufacturing plant, and then they also have another mill in Dover Foxcroft. And in addition to that, they have a logging side of their operation, which has been around longer than their sawmill side of things. So they're able to produce a lot of the lumber that they're able to harvest a lot of the lumber that they ultimately produce into, 2x4s, dimensional wood, other products. And in speaking with them, they have made, even before these tariffs, they've made big investments in this Emfield mill. They've built it from the ground up and have been expanding on it over the past, 5 years. And the progress that they've made there has kind of positioned them in this really good place to receive these tariffs and start trying to sell more wood because of the steeper price to import softwood lumber as well from Canada, because there were tariffs on the raw timber itself, hardwood timber, the stuff that gets turned into pulp and paper, but there's also tariffs on lumber from Canada, which is also cheaper. And because of that, this happened to coincide with plans for the plant to add another shift, another manufacturing shift. So an evening shift instead of just kind of a morning to afternoon, early evening production that they had been working with over the past few years. And that means they added a few more employees, and they're also looking to kind of expand their garage where they store kind of their logging trucks and other equipment. So they were feeling good at the time. They've made a lot of investments into the mill, and they feel like they're paying off. I'll have to check back in with them now to see how things are faring. I haven't looked at the tariff books since the Supreme Court's decision against many of Trump's tariffs last week. But I still think that they're pretty confident before the tariffs, and they're feeling pretty confident, during them as well. So it's been an interesting kind of dichotomy to see both the supply side and the manufacturing side.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. We need to take just a quick break here. If you're just joining us, you are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU FM. This month, I'm joined by our environmental reporter, Emmett Gartner, and our Report for America Corps member, Sean Scott, who covers religion, politics, and society. And we are talking about Emmett's recent reporting on tariffs and the debate over whether federal immigration agents can wear masks or otherwise conceal their identities, and how that compares to the rules for local police, and so much more. So back with you, Emmett. You mentioned the manufacturing of these 2x4s. We've been doing a lot of construction on our house recently. We're always doing a lot of construction on our house, as anyone who lives in an old house in Maine can attest. And it seems to me like the price has gone up, but I wonder if you get any sense from these companies, how much of that cost is getting passed on to consumers.
Yeah, that part I'm a little less sure about. I do know that softwood lumber prices in general lately have, especially, since the pandemic, they've been kind of going up and down, spiking. There's been a long-term trend of them generally going up, I think, when you average all of that out. But if you look at a chart of where prices have gone, especially around the pandemic, I mean, it's just incredible. And a lot of that falls in with the housing market. Housing starts is a big indicator of where softwood lumber prices will be. Right now, from what I've heard, housing starts have kind of declined lately. So with that, production has kind of gone down as well on that side of things. I guess, more so before these tariffs, the data kind of is not as up to date to our conversation, as might be helpful for your current construction project. But yeah, from what I've heard, softwood lumber has generally been trending upwards over time, or remaining relatively stable. And again, the underlying impact of inflation, I mean, that really caused things to get out of hand. So they're kind of settling down a little bit more, but that uptick, I think, is still, being felt by consumers such as yourself, Kate.
And ha okay, the term housing starts, I think, is fairly self-explanatory, but you just mean like a new house being constructed.
Yes,
That's called a housing start.
exactly.
Okay, all right. So you've also, been reporting quite a bit on the underlying health of Maine's forests recently. You reported on a warning from state officials about several potential outbreaks that could impact various trees this year. Tell us a little bit about those.
A lot of this actually came from the Maine Woodland Owners annual forestry forum in Augusta a few weeks ago. There are these presentations both on the health of the forest products economy, and then also a presentation by Department of Agriculture, Conservation, and Forestry officials about where pests are trending right now across Maine forests. Obviously good information for woodlot owners to have. And before that, though, I had been checking in on a few projects to knock back hemlock woolly adelgid, which is this tiny, tiny insect that is from East Asia. And I think there's a species from the Pacific Northwest. Correct me if I'm wrong, but they're not endemic to Maine. And they have a tendency just to completely overrun hemlock trees, which, if you can picture them with me, they have those kind of smaller, tiny needles that are a little softer and splayed out a little flatter. Hemlock tend to grow well in kind of shaded areas of the forest. They're often the oldest tree standing in a specific section of forest. They're really quite beautiful. I'm pretty fond of them. But these adelgid can just completely overwhelm them. They create these nests that kind of have this like woolly like substance around them that can protect their eggs and young, so they can just really make it through some pretty poor conditions. But the state and a lot of conservation groups and landowners, private landowners too, have been working to knock them back. A couple deep freezes and winters prior has helped with that. Although they have this protective fluff around them, they still are affected by deep cold. But there has been also this effort to use biological controls, which are these tiny beetles that are lab grown in the US. They've gone through many, many, trials and studies by the US Forest Service and other research groups to make sure that they're good for release. They're not going to cause some new outbreak of, a beetle that no one wants. And there have been grants and like funding opportunities to cut. They're pretty expensive. I forget what the exact cost is, but it's hundreds of dollars to disperse over, a 50 or whatever acre section of forest. But those efforts have really kicked up recently. Conservation groups, the state, private landowners, like I said, are kind of all pitching in and going in on a big purchase of beetles here and there and trying to see which segments of forest connects to others and kind of see how these beetles could be released in a way that provides benefit across a broad swath of the region. They've been especially present in the mid-coast, which is kind of where these efforts that I've described are honing in right now. So there's been some success there. I think, not out of the woods yet, to use a corny phrase right now. But it has been interesting to watch. And I think people in general are feeling a little bit better about the condition and the outlook for these trees, because they do serve a very important ecosystem service. I mean, they're just kind of the anchor of the woods. So yeah, I've been tracking that.
Yeah, there's a beautiful stand of hemlocks not too far from where I live, and I am protective of it emotionally. In my mind, I'm not allowed to go and fix it, but I think folks will probably have heard quite a bit about well, recently the emerald ash borer and the brown tail moth. Can you talk us through a little bit about what's going on with those two?
Yeah, so two different stories, one more positive than the other. Brown tail moth has been trending down. The state's efforts and again other
groups kind of banding together on this have been pretty effective in bringing down the population there. Just, in 2022, brown tail moths covered around 150,000 acres of woods in Maine. And most recently, the state estimates that's down to 5,000 acres in 2025. So
Wow.
it's
It's a
been an
huge drop.
impressive, yeah, it's been pretty impressive. And for those who might not be familiar with brown tail moth, it's another invasive species. Their caterpillars can cause respiratory issues and painful rashes if you happen to touch them. And the state has had a really widespread campaign to exterminate them. Now getting to the emerald ash borer, which is a slightly more sorrowful story. Again, another invasive species, and as their name might hint at, they target ash trees, and there can be a variety of species. It can be green ash, and white ash, and they bore into the trees. They lay eggs, and they're pretty effective in killing the trees within a few years to 10 years. So during this presentation, a state official said that it's been the impacts are kind of there. It's the range of their the infestation is kind of well known, but to see what the die-off will look like will take a little while, because it does take a few years for these insects to kind of take down a tree. The State Forest Service has a monitoring program, and they're using biocontrol measures kind of similar to the hemlock woolly adelgid. Instead of beetles, it's these tiny looking wasp things that can feast on the ash borers. But overall, I mean, across New England, it's been, and elsewhere in the United States, it's been, a pretty negative trend. And on top of all of that is just kind of the ash trees' cultural significance here in Maine, especially. I mean, Wabanaki Nations have used it for generations to make baskets, and it's just a valuable timber tree as well, brown ash bark specifically for basket making. So yeah, that's a little bit less of a positive story.
Yeah, I think I believe that they've found them also not too far from where I live and are definitely monitoring them. In terms of these all of these pests, what do you say, what would you say is which one would you say is of the most concern to the forest products industry?
That's a good question. I mean, ash borer is one. I spoke, in addition to the Pleasant River lumber folks, I spoke with a hardwood lumber manufacturer based out of, I think, Milo, and he uses ash to make furniture, cabinetry, flooring, and that's been a hit. I think, in addition to that, spruce budworm has been an issue in some parts. That's kind of a concern, because, as we've said, spruce, this softwood as lumber is important. So yeah, it's kind of a mix of all of these things. Hemlock isn't really used too much in manufacturing, as far as I know. So I think that's of less concern. That might be more of like broader ecosystem thing. Yeah, that's kind of the temperature I've taken there.
Well, thank you so much. This is really great reporting. I urge everyone to go and read the stories. They'll all be linked in the show notes. We are gonna switch gears a little bit and talk to Sean Scott about some reporting he's done on federal immigration raids, and then talk about a panel that you did, Sean, not too long ago up in Bangor, which was really fascinating. So, Sean, you recently reported a story that looked at the debate over how federal agents have or some cases have not been identifying themselves while conducting immigration enforcement. And you looked specifically at what the rules are for law enforcement officials in Maine. So before we get into what you found, can you tell us a bit about what prompted you and Christian Moravec, who worked with you on this story? She's another Monitor reporter. What prompted the two of you to look into this?
Yeah, so we kind of in January, just to give farther background, when we had a heads up that ICE and federal agents were likely going to be doing some heavy enforcement in Maine, and what they called Operation Catch of the Day, we as a newsroom were pretty focused on that and trying to cover different angles from it. And then after that ended, Christian and I did some additional reporting about what we had found during the week or so that that was going on, which was we were looking into kind of the intimidation tactics that ICE observers were saying that they had experienced from federal agents. So part of that reporting process, we were looking at a lot of different videos and a lot of footage from people, and we saw what had been in national media and media coming out of Minneapolis as well, which is a lot of federal agents wearing masks or obscuring their identities in other ways, or maybe not identifying themselves if someone asks for a name. So this story, looking more specifically at how are federal agents identifying themselves and what are the rules, it kind of came out of seeing that trend in earlier reporting, and we decided to look at it more specifically.
Yeah, that's it's been I know I certainly had questions, as I think a lot of folks did when I saw the photos of ICE agents, and I thought, are you allowed to do that? Are you allowed to walk around and detain someone without identifying yourself or without necessarily having a clear uniform. And we're going to get to that question. But first, listeners are probably pretty familiar with the debate that's playing out nationally and the reforms Democrats are pushing for in Congress. But can you just briefly give us a lay of the land on that?
Yeah, so in the past couple of months, in January, federal agents killed two US citizens in Minneapolis that leaders at a federal level had already been debating the tactics that immigration enforcement and Customs and Border Patrol were using. But those two incidents kind of supercharged the whole conversation. Building from there, it happened around the time that a funding deadline for the government was coming up, and there was pressure from Democrats not to sign a bill that would have it would have continued to fund ICE without any additional restrictions. So what happened eventually was they separated out the Department of Homeland Security budgets from the rest of the bills. So now we are in a partial shutdown for the Department of Homeland Security while leaders in Congress are debating what additional measures, if any, would be attached to continued funding for ICE. The biggest items in that are what Democrats would like for federal immigration enforcement agents to carry identification on them or clearly display the agency that they're working for, not wear masks, require body cameras to be worn, and some other safety and accountability measures before they will agree to funding. And at the time that we're recording this now, there is not really any agreement happening. So I'm not sure how much longer that will take, but right now it does not seem to be getting closer to a final bill.
To be perfectly honest, I did not realize that there was such a thing as a partial government shutdown. I mean, I guess I'd heard the term, but I didn't really understand what exactly that meant. So it's, yeah, thank you. It's really interesting that you can shut down one agency and that's what they would refer to it as.
Yeah, I was very surprised to learn that you can do a partial shutdown this year, considering that we just went through the longest ever full shutdown like 6 months ago. But yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah. We need congressional reporters to tell us what's going on. It is so complicated over there. We need to take another quick break. If you're just joining us, you are listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour on WERU-FM. This month, I am joined by our environmental reporter Emmett Gartner and our Report for America Corps member Sean Scott, who covers religion, politics, and society. And we are talking about tariffs, the forest products industry, and the debate over federal immigration agents and their identities, and a lot more. So, Sean, you just laid out for us what is going on at the federal level in terms of the DHS budget. That's what's up for debate there. There have been attempts by state legislatures to pass their own laws that would affect how federal agents conduct operations in their states. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the state level efforts, I kind of think of them in two main tracks. There's the unmasking efforts, and then there are the identification efforts. So I think in terms of unmasking, those are laws that prevent law enforcement agents from wearing masks while conducting law enforcement activity in most circumstances. So California had initially put forward one of those laws, and this is probably the most high-profile example. And that law was eventually struck down by a federal judge, but it was struck down because it only applied to federal agents. It didn't equally apply to state and local agents. And that has prompted some states, including California, to go forward with new efforts that do apply to all law enforcement agents, and those ones seem more likely to pass muster in the federal courts. And Maine, actually, last fall, a state representative had introduced a bill that would have done something similar, but they did not end up picking it up for consideration this session. So there's not a current Maine effort that I'm aware of to make a law about this. But then the second track that accountability measures are taking on a state level is requirements for law enforcement agents to identify themselves. That could be name tags. It could be that they need to clearly display what agency they're working for somewhere on their body. And that actually, going back to California, they also have an identification law, and that one was upheld in the federal court. So it seems that that one is a more sure bet for states to take.
And so California's the most high profile, but you said there might be a couple others in the works as well.
Yeah, Vermont, Washington, Maryland, Oregon. I know that all of those ones have been considering masking laws specifically.
One of the arguments by those who are pushing for those reforms in this area is that, the practices that we're used to seeing by now by ICE and Border Patrol have really diverged from, I think, what most people are familiar with from law enforcement agents in their own communities. Like we just talked about, I certainly had questions because I've only encountered law enforcement when they are very identifiable, typically with name badges and at the very least like in uniform, very clearly law enforcement officers. So, for this piece that you wrote, which was so fascinating, you really looked at what the rules are around local law enforcement officers in Maine. So take us through that. What did you find?
Yeah, as a starting point for that, I think that what was most surprising to me in reporting on it, and this came up in several discussions with Christian and our editors as we were actually putting the story together, was that this is really guided on an individual departmental policy level. It is not like there are a host of state laws or federal laws dictating how officers identify themselves or how they conduct themselves in terms of whether or not they are clearly identifiable when they're interacting with someone. But that being said, what we did find on a state level from all the departments that we spoke to. They do tend to have a written uniform policy that requires them to, it lays out like when they're required to be in uniform, when they can do plain clothes or undercover work, what a uniform actually looks like. They tend to have in the written policy that there is a name tag component to it and an agency component to it. These policies, they also, they tend to have written policies. I think we found at least 10 of the agencies that we looked at had somewhere in written policy a requirement that agents do identify themselves, either in language saying something like, greet the person courteously as you're making a traffic stop and introduce yourself. Or if someone asks for your name, provide it. They'd like to use the word courteously. I feel like I saw that several times. But the point being that there is a requirement for a lot of these agencies that they do provide their names when asked. We did find the idea of in media, I feel like you see people asking for the name and badge number, and we found that it is not a universal thing that agents have badge numbers. A lot of departments in Maine, that's just not a practice because they don't have enough members on staff that that's necessary. So there's a little bit of a misconception there, but the departments that we talked to also said that their officers generally, when they're asked for a badge, they will badge number, they will explain that to people.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of the departments around me. A lot of them are just a couple of officers, and I think most people in the community certainly know who they are. Now you talked about how there are written policies for this, but these are not, just to be clear, like these are not legal requirements, right? These are customs practices policies, but they are not anywhere in state statute. Is that correct?
Mostly correct. There is, it's this is almost entirely led on a policy level, like an individual departmental policy. We did find one federal law that says that immigration officers should identify themselves as an immigration officer when they're conducting an arrest. Whether or not that is happening is more up for debate in the instances that we've seen. And then there are a couple of requirements in state law that in Maine, officers with sheriff's departments should wear distinctive uniforms, but that doesn't mention name tags at all.
Interesting. Well, you and Christian called a number of police departments and sheriff's offices around the state for this story. What did they have to say?
Yeah, they. The point that came up with most of the people we talked to is these policies on being clearly identifiable and being open and transparent with a person as you're making arrest and providing your name if you're asked is done for both officer safety and public safety. If you are being arrested, or if someone pulls you over on the side of the road, they have their lights going, they have a siren going. But there's no way for you to tell whether or not they are someone with a law enforcement agency that has the authority to pull you over. You are not as motivated to comply with what's happening. I spoke to the Androscoggin County Sheriff, and he said that they have a standing practice. If you are an officer or a deputy in an unmarked vehicle, you are not allowed to start a traffic, you're not allowed to initiate a traffic stop unless you are in uniform. I mean, there are all of these policies have exceptions for extraordinary circumstances. Like someone brought up, if you're running into a burning building, you're not going to stop and give someone your name first. But that there is this practice of making sure when you're conducting law enforcement activity that the people that you're engaging with in the public are aware that you have the authority to be conducting that activity to ensure compliance and safety. Another aspect of that was brought up is if someone does have a complaint, They think that the officer mistreated them, or they just have something else that they want to follow up on. It's easier for a department to keep track of those complaints if the person making the complaint knows who they're referring to. So that's just another kind of accountability side of it that they brought up.
Yeah, I can imagine. I don't know how I would react if I were pulled over by somebody who didn't, immediately look like a law enforcement agent. I think that would be really, it would be alarming. You talked to several civil rights lawyers for this piece. What was their take on all of this?
They kind of echoed the law enforcement take that we heard in terms of transparency and safety concerns. Regarding the masking and refusing to identify themselves at a federal level, two of the lawyers that we spoke to explicitly described it as akin to the secret police. If you establish a force that is not required to identify themselves and there is not some level of public oversight, they just said that that seems like you are establishing a secret police force, which is not something that traditionally has existed in the US. They also described this as kind of building on other escalatory practices that they've seen with federal agents. Whether or not you get the name of the officer may not be as important to you if your window has been smashed in already. That was something I think our reporter Rose had a story about a civil engineer whose window on his car was smashed by federal agents. So it just kind of builds on other practices that raise concerns about whether or not people's rights are being violated and whether or not there is some level of accountability if there is misconduct.
And I know you were in contact with Representative Shelley Pinkry's office. What did she have to say about all of this?
Yeah, we reached out to Representative Pingree's office because she has sponsored a bill called the Stop ICE Intimidation Act that touches on a lot of the similar themes here in terms of accountability, but specifically not funding. The goal is to reduce funding for ICE surveillance efforts. And when we spoke to her, she told us, or when we emailed with her, we did not directly speak with her, but in email, she told us that she believes it's time to abolish ICE, but that at a minimum, as these votes for whether or not to continue funding DHS come in, she will not vote for those without specific safety measures like the body cameras and the identification. One of the reasons that identification was so important that she raised was that there is a risk of impersonation going on here, and we actually did find some reporting about impersonation from last year where people might go up and pretend to be an ICE officer and engage with people in an inappropriate way, or like make an arrest or attempt to make an arrest when they don't have the authority to do that. She also described an incident that happened in Portland last fall, where the DEA made an arrest, an immigration arrest on behalf of ICE, but the person that they were arresting did not know that they were DEA agents or ICE agents. And she said that that took a number of phone calls to figure out what had happened. So that's just kind of another example of without clearly identifying ICE or CBP or the agency that you're working with. It just makes it harder to follow up as these arrests happen.
Well, kind of to that end, I remember having a conversation with you at some you and Christian, I think, at some point about the coordination between federal and local law enforcement. What can you tell us about how much coordination there is there? I mean, were local police departments made aware that ICE was going to be doing these targeted raids in advance, as far as you know?
So that was not something that we explicitly focused on in our reporting. It did come up in a couple conversations. One person that I spoke to said that their department didn't know and didn't want to know when ICE was in town, but another said that they did get advance warning if ICE was going to conduct operations. I know that leading up to Operation Catch of the Day, because that was reported fairly widely, like a week in advance or so, law enforcement agencies did speak with each other. I spoke to one sheriff who was talking about having conversations in advance regarding what safety concerns they may have for it. But I can't speak to whether or not the federal government had directly informed those agencies.
Well, we only have a couple of minutes left here, but I did want to just briefly note for listeners, Sean hosted a panel discussion at the Bangor Public Library what, last month, a couple, yeah, last month. It's February, so this will run in March. And he hosted a panel discussion with leaders of several different faith-based organizations who provide social services across the state. You can find the full discussion on our website, themainmonitor.org. But I just wanted briefly, Sean, because this was a really interesting talk. What was the thinking behind that conversation? And tell it, give us maybe like a top line takeaway or two.
Yeah, the idea for the panel came about because last fall I was reporting on amid SNAP benefits. SNAP benefits had been paused by the Trump administration during the government shutdown. So I guess timely there. And I was reporting on the impact that that had on food pantries. And a lot of the food pantries in the state are faith-based. So as I was doing that reporting, I was learning more about the kind of federal funding cuts that have happened over time that have impacted those organizations as well. And it put me on a train of thought about the types of social services that faith-based organizations are providing and how that works in Maine in particular, because we are one of the least religious states in the country. So the panel was really a discussion about three different approaches that these organizations are taking. Three very different organizations. So we had Michael Smith with Catholic Charities of Maine, which is a huge statewide organization with like 17 different initiatives that they're involved in. But they do, we were especially focused on food and Aroostook. And then we also talked to Greater Bangor area street pastors, Anna Phillips, and they do like work each day or each Friday, just meeting people on the street. And then Hope Haven Gospel Mission in Lewiston, which is a shelter. So we just talked about the way that faith impacts their work, the way that federal funding has impacted their work, and how different faith organizations kind of work together to meet the needs of people in the state.
That is great. And again, you can find that full discussion on our website at themainmonitor.org. You've been listening to the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, a nonpartisan independent publication of the Maine Center for Public Interest Reporting. We were joined today by Emmett Gartner and Sean Scott. You can read their work at themainmonitor.org. Questions or comments related to the radio program can be sent to news@weru.org. If you have stories you want to share with us, you can find our emails at themainmonitor.org. This broadcast is happens on the first Thursday of every month at 4 p.m. You can also listen on the WERU app, subscribe to the show as a podcast, or download archive shows at weru.org. For the Maine Monitor Radio Hour, I'm Kate Koff, and this is Community Radio WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill. Thanks, everyone.